This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yee Swuhiben. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Zimbabwe's increasingly frail 93-year-old leader has said he will run in next year's election after more than three decades in power. But within Robert Mugabe's party, the once whispered challenge to name a successor has become louder and more insistent. The most recent voice to speak up, his wife, who harbors political ambitions.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also, the death toll from Tuesday's Boko Haram ambush in northeastern Nigeria has risen to nearly 50, and more than 113,400 migrants and refugees have arrived in Europe by sea so far this year.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
The death toll from Tuesday's Boko Haram ambush in northeastern Nigeria has risen to nearly 50. The initial death toll in the attack on the military convoy was 10. The Associated Press reports the bodies of 18 soldiers and 30 others have been brought to Maiduguri, capital of Borno State. 10 oil experts from the University of Maiduguri were abducted in the attack near Lake Chad. They were part of a government operation to look for oil deposits. Reporter John Bosco was following developments. From Maiduguri, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about why it took 3 days to get a more accurate casualty figure.
Well, you know how it is. There is what we call official figure, and there is the truth of the matter. So the reports you get from people in the know is different from the reports that is given out as official figure. That is why. So we took our time to find out what really happened, who escaped, who was hospitalized, who was dead. In the end, people in the know came up with this number, about 50 dead as a result of the attack.
Now, what about the 10 university workers who were abducted? Any word on them?
So far, no news has been had. But usually what the terrorists do is that they come up with a video to say they have such and such people with them when they give their reports. But as I speak to you right now, there are some people who are still missing.
John, tell us about the government's efforts to look for oil in that region. I mean, that's a very insecure region. Why is it taking the chance to explore for oil when Boko Haram is still capable of launching attacks like the one that happened this week?
That is something that is very confusing to most Nigerians. Oil exploration is political because oil in Nigeria is a predominantly southern thing. Its deposit is in the south. Now, the government is trying to expand areas where oil is got from. So that is why they came to the shores of the Lake Chad to look for oil. As much as everybody is aware of, the area is still not secured enough for any activity of oil exploration to go on. You know, if oil is discovered in the north, it is a plus for Nigeria as a country in totality. I will know what the authorities in their wisdom stand to gain by sending people to the field, even though it is not very secured. But getting oil in the northern region is also a good thing.
That's reporter John Bosco from Maiduguri, Nigeria. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Zimbabwe's increasingly frail 93-year-old leader has said he will run in next year's election after more than three decades in power. But within Robert Mugabe's party, the once whispered challenge to name a successor has become louder and more insistent. The most recent voice to speak up, his wife, who harbors political ambitions. VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg, South Africa, has the story with additional reporting by Sebastian Mumfu in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe is already the world's oldest living head of state. Mugabe says he is fit enough to run for re-election next year and has batted away whispers about who he will choose to follow him when he succumbs to his inevitable death. In February, as Mugabe turned 93, he told the state broadcaster that he still felt he was up to the task of being president, and that the majority of Zimbabweans feel that no successor is as acceptable as I am. As he continues to shuttle to and from Singapore for medical treatment, the call for him to name a replacement has grown louder. The most recent and loudest voice to call for a successor is also the most unexpected, his wife. 52-year-old Grace Mugabe raised the delicate issue at this week's gathering of the Women's League of the ruling ZANU-PF party.
I know President says, no, I don't want to impose any candidate. But I've always argued with him that you have the role, you have the right to be part of that process because we respect him. Saka, his word will be final. Mark my words, his word will be final.
Grace Mugabe is also on the short list of Zimbabwean public figures rumored to be trying to succeed him, alongside Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Professor Shadrach Guto of the University of South Africa says the president's wife is clearly making a play to be his pick, but he says she is wrong about one thing. President Mugabe's word is only final as long as he lives.
She wants the position, but I'm saying it will occur as soon as he goes. In other words, he passes away. Grace doesn't have a political power in Zimbabwe at all. And therefore, a lot of struggles will start to take place with him.
Proposition analyst Jacob Mufume told VOA that he thinks Mugabe has already handed the reins to his wife. Zimbabwe's struggling economy has been blamed on the president's decisions during his 36 years in power, and the couple have been repeatedly accused of corruption and mismanagement.
He actually believes that he's running the country when he is not. That's how bad it is. His wife is running the country. The other half of the country is being run by Vice President Mnangagwa. The other half is run by Grace Mugabe, grabbing farms and dams and whatever she wants to do at that particular time. So basically we are on autopilot as a country, and it is a shame that we are failing to retire an old man to an old people's home.
And what does the president think? When asked, his response was slow, halting, and far from clear.
Other countries have more than two. Why can't we have three deputies, two choices, the one to revert to our position of two vice presidents and one being a lady, but another of adding another position of a vice president? We have three vice presidents and one a woman.
Zimbabwe votes in 2018 with President Mugabe leading the ruling party's ticket. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The International Organization for Migration says more than 113,400 migrants and refugees have arrived in Europe by sea so far this year. Nearly 2,400 have died trying to make the journey. 85% of the new arrivals went to Italy, followed by Greece, Spain, and Cyprus.
Earlier this week, Fayez al-Sarraj, the head of Libya's UN-backed government, and General Khalifa Haftar, the leader of Libyan National Army, met in Paris with French President Emmanuel Macron. The rival leaders signed off on a 10-point roadmap in which they committed not to fight each other and hold national elections possibly next year. Rhiannon Smith is managing director of the London-based consultancy group Libya Analysis. She spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi on the potential of this new roadmap.
Although they have agreed to a ceasefire in this recent Paris agreement, the forces under Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj, under the Government of National Accord, and under Khalifa Haftar, which is the Libyan National Army, are not currently engaged in direct fighting in Libya. So in terms of it being doable, yes, that aspect is, but that doesn't mean that there won't be fighting between other factions who are not included in this deal in Libya. Insofar as elections are concerned, it is, I believe, feasible for elections to take place in Libya. They hope to take place next year. It may take longer. And again, the key thing to note here is that although we have Sarraj, who has some political legitimacy in western Libya, and Haftar, who has a military legitimacy in eastern Libya, There are many factions who will oppose them having elections and who also will feel threatened that they will lose their power and their sort of, it will go against their interests if elections are held. So there's a very long way to translating this agreement into getting agreement from all factions and translating that into elections on the ground.
The joint document said the solution to the Libyan crisis can only be a political one and requires a national reconciliation process involving all Libyans. What's new in this pledge?
The national reconciliation, the political solution, is not new in the sense that the Skhirat Agreement in 2015, also known as the Libyan Political Agreement, is based on this foundation of reconciliation and having only a political solution. And this is what many of the Libyan political parties and international actors have committed to. The key thing about this agreement is that it's Khalifa Haftar who has signed his name, who has committed to a political solution in theory. So until now, Haftar has always rejected any sort of political negotiation. He's rejected a political solution. Indeed, he's always advocated for a military solution to Libya's problems, you know, through wiping out his rivals and terrorists, so, as he called them. So that is the key difference here. Again, it seems likely that the only reason that he has changed his tune is that committing to a political solution now will benefit him. Haftar has now strengthened a lot. He has a lot more international legitimacy. He has strong support of Egypt and the UAE, who are now sort of have the upper hand in the regional dynamics. So it may well be that Haftar now sees that elections and a political solution is something that he could win, and this would actually gain him more power. So that's a significant change with this agreement in Paris.
But what would define military actions that could be considered counter-terrorism and therefore allowed under that deal?
Now, this is the eternal question. What counts as a terrorist? Who is a terrorist? What is a terrorist act? And in the case of this agreement, there is obviously no clarification, although Haftar, in an interview after the agreement was made in Paris, you know, said this includes Islamic State, Al-Qaeda-linked groups, and also the Muslim Brotherhood, which obviously many others do not consider as a terrorist group. And we also know that Haftar has, since he launched Operation Dignity in 2014, he has classed all of his rivals as terrorists. So I think it's likely this will allow Haftar to continue his battle against the Derna Mujahideen Shura Council in Derna, and even in Tripoli, where he has said there are many terrorists and, you know, there are a lot of hardline Islamist groups. So it does mean that we're likely to see Haftar continuing to use military force in the same way that he has done to date.
That was Rhiannon Smith, Managing Director of the London-based Libya Analysis. She spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib. 18 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The death toll from Tuesday's Boko Haram ambush in northeastern Nigeria has risen to nearly 50. And after more than three decades in power, the 93-year-old president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe, says he will run in next year's election. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
South Africa's central bank says country's recession may be over. It's currently analyzing economic data from the second quarter after the country slipped into its first recession in 8 years earlier this year. The central bank governor says we believe that the worst is over and that the second quarter will show positive growth. However, some are advising against too much optimism. David Shapiro is deputy chairman of Sasfin Securities. From Johannesburg, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about South Africa's economy.
I still think things are pretty difficult at the moment. In fact, we did reduce interest rates last week. And one of the reasons we reduced interest rates was largely because of the poor growth outlook. Things are improving after some very difficult months. You know, the drought has broken in most of the country, although in the Western Cape, which is the most beautiful part of the country, things have been very, very difficult there. That's where the vineyards are. There's a lot of apple farms and so on. and they're under a bit of pressure. It's, nationally, we're out of the drought, and we started to see a stabilization in commodity prices after a very difficult year. But what's dragging us down is still very low business and consumer confidence. And to a large extent, that's coming from the politics of the country, where the leading party, the ANC, is still divided. There's a lot of mistrust in the president, President Zuma, a lot of calls for his departure. The ANC is meeting at the end of December to choose a new head, who will obviously be the new president in 2019. That's if the ANC can hold on to its votes. And that's causing a lot of uncertainty in the country. So we're not out of the woods, although we expect things to be better in the next 6 months.
Now, the bank is forecasting the economy will grow by 0.5% this year and expects it to rise to 1.5% possibly in the next 2 years. Would you agree with that?
We agree with that, but the danger is that we're a country where that growth, even if you look at the United States, is forecast to grow at about 1.9% this year. So we're way, way below even somewhere like the United States, remembering that we are a developing country. We're way below the other developing countries, particularly in Asia, and even the world economy, we're below that. So what's taken us down has been poor manufacturing and poor mining. So we've got to work our way through it. That's the massive challenge that South Africa has, is how to dig itself out of the hole. So we're certainly better than we were in the last few months, and we just hope this trend can continue and we can introduce the kind of reforms that we need, structural reforms that we need to get growth going. South Africa is a country which is blessed with so many natural resources. Everything is in favor of this country growing a lot more.
Now, you had mentioned some structural reforms. What are you referring to?
I think we need to relook at labor. Also, from a political point of view, we've been a democracy now since 1994, but it's going to take a long time to really get rid of the drawbacks that apartheid brought. I think we need to move away from politics in trying to transform it too fast. So I think that's where the structural reforms will come. Structural reforms mainly in labor, also in education, possibly in business areas as well. When I say labor, you know, I think that we're moving towards a minimum wage. We have massive unemployment here, massive unemployment of around 27%, the highest, I think, in the world, and particularly amongst youth. And we've got to try and find policies and structure the economy that we can actually absorb a lot of that labor.
What is South Africa's credit rating these days?
On the brink of disaster. We are just holding up. And if we continue without structural economic reforms, changing the shape of our economy, that we might actually be rated junk, in which case a lot of institutions that are holding our bonds will be forced because of their mandates to sell. So it's a massive worry. And if it does happen, it could also alter the course of the rand, which has been holding up very well. So it's one of the big weights overhanging the economy at the moment.
That's David Shapiro, Deputy Chairman of Sasfin Securities. From Johannesburg, he spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
According to the International Union for Conservation of Nature, there are 41,415 endangered species on Earth right now. That includes the bonobo, a Central African ape known for its sex life, its peaceful nature, and its vital role in keeping the rainforest healthy. To learn more about this creature, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Michael Hurley of the Bonobo Conservation Trust, a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. and the DRC. Hurley began by noting an essentially kinship between bonobos and humans.
A bonobo is a great ape, closely related to us. We are a great ape. But bonobos are the last discovered and least known great ape, and they're a very special species. They live only in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in very isolated and hard-to-access rainforests.
What do bonobos look like, and can you tell me a little bit about what's special about them and their groups?
They look very much like a chimpanzee, except they stand erect more often like humans, and their shoulders are more narrow like humans. but they are a matriarchal society, which means the females rule the roost. Perhaps because of that, they tend to be more cooperative and they are more sharing in nature. They're more empathetic. Therefore, we can learn a great deal from them. There are many reasons why they're more peaceful. One could say because they've evolved in an area where there's less competition with other great apes for food. Another could be genetics. We still need to study that.
I understand that they're very amorous. There's a lot of sex going on in bonobo life.
They do have more sex. They have sex with everyone and anyone all the time. They tend to have sex when they're sharing food. Sex does reduce tension. It could, in our own culture, reduce more tensions if people just had more sex.
Would that be another reason for their pacific qualities?
Definitely.
Now, I notice you're part of the Bonobo Conservation Initiative. Is there a problem with the number of bonobos? Are they endangered?
Bonobos have been devastated mainly through the bushmeat trade and through the destruction of their habitat. It's extremely serious. They may be one of the most threatened great apes on Earth. We have to be careful of that, and we also have to reduce the amount of bushmeat hunting. They're a food. Like, they perceive them as a food as they perceive a bush pig. They're a large animal, and when you kill them, there's a lot to eat. However, there are some cultures and some tribes that do recognize kinship between humans and bonobos and feel that bonobos are relatives. This is something that is relatively new in our own culture, a recognition that we're related to great apes. In some of these cultures, they have stories and songs and traditions about their relationship with bonobos. So in those cultures, it's taboo to hunt bonobos, and you very often find bonobos living close to villages where they actually feel more protected than living out in the wild where there may be more threat from outside commercial bushmeat hunters and poachers.
If bonobos are so important to the local ecology of the rainforest and beyond, why would local people hunt them at all? I mean, why would any tribes do that? It seems self-defeating.
In most cases, it's not just the local villagers who are just hunting out all the bonobos and all the species. It's commercial hunters. It's become a very big trade. There's millions of tons of bushmeat going into Heathrow Airport, for example. Rafts and rafts of elephant meat and bonobo meat and everything else coming out of the jungle. That's not for local sustenance. The local people understand that their own forests are depleted, and they've seen the results of the depletion of the forest. When some species are missing from the ecosystem, the entire ecosystem starts degrading. A bonobo is a flagship species, or also an umbrella species. Recent studies have shown that bonobos are, in a sense, gardeners of the forest, meaning that the fruits that they eat, they then poop out, and in their poop there are seeds that germinate at a much higher rate than seeds that just fall to the ground and are germinated. So they help spread some of these fruiting trees throughout the forest. They help, therefore, maintain diversity in the forest. That creates a healthier forest, which is then good for all of the other species, including humans. So some of these forest areas without bonobos may start to degrade. The forests themselves may not survive. So the forests are more robust and healthy with bonobos living in them. So we protect bonobos, and we are the Bonobo Conservation Initiative, but ultimately we want to protect all the species in the forest, and ultimately the forest itself, which provides watersheds, which contributes to the great watershed of the Congo River, which provides genetic diversity, which sequesters carbon, which is necessary for the health of the entire planet. So by protecting bonobos, we're helping our own planet to be healthy.
That was Michael Hurley of the Bonobo Conservation Trust, a nonprofit with offices in Washington, D.C. and the DRC. He spoke recently with VOA's Adam Phillips at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.